scientists, and I'm interviewing PhDs and MDs who are doing incredible work in unusual anomalies like parapsychology. So if you're at all interested in alternative health, take a look at that YouTube channel. Okay, so as I said, our show tonight is about homelessness in our area, and the continuum of care count that was done last March 28th, they found that there were 993 people who were sheltered with FEMA in emergency shelters and in transitional housing, 420 people, and there were 891 people who were living in no shelter. About one in four of those who were unsheltered and agreed to share why they were unsheltered said they were campfire survivors and that it was their first time experiencing homelessness. But 15% said they were campfire survivors and had already experienced homelessness before. So my question to, let's start with Bob and Leslie from CHAT, the Chico Housing Action Team, and could you fill us in on the problem? How many people are homeless in Butte County and why?
Well, hi. Thanks. The thing about the point in time count, it's hard to know how accurate it is, but we can be assured that a lot of people were missed because in particular campfire survivors are not necessarily living out on the street or on a park bench or something where you would see them there. Hundreds or probably thousands of them, of course, are staying in people's homes of friends and relatives or in their garage or parking a van in their driveway or something like that. So it's undoubtedly a very low count. So unsheltered is one category, what you're talking about, people actually outside. But then there's a category of people living someplace not meant for human habitation, like in a car. And an awful lot of people, even with children and everything else, are in cars or travel trailers that are just meant for, you know, a brief vacation that you can barely turn around in some of them, and then people will be living in. Not very pleasant. So
we all say normally they do that count in January, and this year because of the fire it didn't happen till later. And the particular day that we were out in the streets trying to do the count, it was cold and it was raining. People didn't want to be out there. They left early. Some of them didn't show up. So there was a dramatic undercount that day, unfortunately, because those of us who do work in the streets and go out under the bridges and into the, you know, other areas, waterways, whatever, know how dramatic it is and how many people are there and how many people are from the ridge, but also how many people are from the Chico area, the city of Chico, that are still out there right now in the streets. And it's pretty overwhelming for us to see that number. One of the unique things is about CHAT that we have 119 people in our homes right now off the street. And if you think about how many people they give this count, which we think is inaccurate, the number of people actually on the street, not in a vehicle, not in a porch, or, you know, we have about 20% of the people on the street in our houses right now, if you consider 119 people that we have housed, which is pretty exciting on one level. And the other level, it's so under served this community that we really, really need to have more housing, truly affordable housing, because we just can't keep up. We get calls. I don't care where we go. We get calls. You go into a place because somebody is injured. You take them in, and the staff is asking you, can you take care of these three people who need to be out because we don't have any space for them? It's just overwhelming for us.
So how many roughly? I'm not clear how many people roughly are living in their cars, how many are living in, like, Jesus Center, how many are living under freeway passages. How many are there?
Well, that's the thing. Nobody knows. There's no way to know. And that's what the point in time count is for, is to try to get a count. But if you see a motorhome parked by the road or in someone's driveway or in their yard, are you going to go knock on the door and say, are you homeless? It's pretty tough, especially, as Bob says, unfortunately, that day of the count, it was raining. And homeless people, when the weather's bad, they're obviously going to try to get inside and get some kind of shelter, whatever they have, to get out of the way of the weather. So they aren't out and about as much as they would be on a nice day. So it's honestly, it's almost impossible to know.
But what we do know is, unless they refer to it, is that if you drive around Chico, you see motorhomes, small units, trailers everywhere in yards. Sometimes you'll see two and three trailers in a yard. We know now that there's about 19,000 more people in our community. Those people don't have houses. Many of them don't have houses. There just weren't that many before. We had about a 1% vacancy rate prior to the... And now, Ed Mayer just recently said, well, it's zero now. There is no vacancy rate. As something empties, there's a lineup of people to get into that home. We also know that prices have gone up dramatically for rentals. And one of the things after the city council so wisely said you can't raise rent more than 10%, many of the homeowners are evicting. And then they're raising the rent. So we see that all over. We've seen it happen to us. We see what's happening because they figure, well, I can raise the rent because I know I can get it. So this is a way to make more money than that 10% is to evict. And so now we're talking, do we have to go back to the city council and say it has to be eviction with costs? So it's a constant battle for us to try and stay on top of what's happening in the community. With the homeless people, and I even have a problem calling it homeless people. It's people that are unhoused at this point. They have been housed in the past. Most of them have had jobs. They've had a history. They're unhoused right now because of the economic circumstances in this country as well as in Chico.
Bob, I like to refer to them as people who have lost their housing.
People who have lost their housing.
Almost everybody had housing, and we see them a lot of times. You see people, and you just sort of think of them as almost like another category of human being. And they're just people who had a house at some point, and they've lost it for whatever reasons. They weren't born into homelessness,
right.
Generally.
I met a woman a little while ago along the Comanche Creek, and she was just... She was beside herself. I mean, I was talking to her, and what she said to me ultimately, she said, Bob, all I want... It's a door to close and a lock to lock. I raised my three kids. I worked my whole life. I find myself homeless for the first time in my life. I don't know what to do. I'm scared on the street every night. I try to hide because of what could happen to me. That's who we're dealing with on our streets right now.
And where was she sleeping?
She was sleeping. She was hiding. I'm not going to say, but she was hiding somewhere safe away from other people, which made her unsafe in many other ways.
You mean in a natural environment?
In a natural environment. Yeah. She was hiding in our waterways to make sure that she was safe.
Did she have a vehicle?
She did not have a vehicle.
Oh, wow.
She had a bicycle, actually. So, yes, she did have a vehicle. She had a bicycle. And all her belongings were on that bicycle, actually. And she was an amazing woman, but something had happened to her to end up her on the street. And many of our people in our house is the same thing. We have people with diabetes, with heart disease, with family members that were in crisis with medical. You name it, and we have people in our houses that have had a situation that has put them on the street. And as she said, they look at me like I'm an animal. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is so sad that we have that in us. That we see those who have less, that we demean them to make ourselves feel good about what we are willing to do. The NIMBYism, the other things that happen in our community,
almost
we can justify it.
Blaming people for being poor, for having
being
problems.
Addicts.
That and just, poverty. Sometimes it's medical bankruptcies and things like that. Sometimes they've had some kind of crisis in their life to get them in that situation. And I think Bob's probably right. We don't want to think that could happen to us, but in reality...
There's that old saying, there for the grace of God, go I.
Right.
I think of that all the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
That luck is involved.
Sure.
Or mm-hmm. having... Yeah. Let's get back to chat later. Let's introduce Destin.
Hello.
And tell us a little bit about your experience with homelessness and how you got in and out of it.
It happened so fast. My brother and I were living down in San Diego. And we both had jobs, and we just got there, and we're staying with some friends temporarily. Started saving money for rent and started going around. To look for an apartment, and because we had relocated, and with the intent to go to school, and
Do you mind asking how old you were at that point?
That time I was 38. So what had happened was working over the course and deciding to return to school as a student full-time was because without the education, it was getting so much harder to actually pay the rent, buy food, make sure that you get your medical taken care of, all those different things. And like I said, a couple bad months, and then we were just there. We were in the car, and it was a very, very scary situation.
What about family support?
Unfortunately, a lot of the people in my family that were very supportive of us and stuff like that had passed. And I know that with a lot of other individuals that I've met who have gone through the same type of situation that I have, that's been something that they've gone through too, is that they weren't able to get the support because there was no one there. Then when we got back in the school, we were still housing insecure or homeless. Living in the car, fortunately, we had the option to live in the car. And like what Bob was saying about hiding, yeah, we were hiding in plain sight in the car and finding parking spots and areas in town and stuff like that. When we moved up here, the same thing. We didn't realize at the time my brother had gone to Chico State 20 years prior. And we decided to come up here because at the time we believed that the cost of living would be less expensive and we would have a greater opportunity. Not knowing until the other day, which we just in fact read, but what Bob had just said, that the housing was under 1% before the campfire. So that was something we just...
partly because it's a college community,
yes.
Right?
So yeah, we were living in the car.
And then how does one go to the bathroom, take a shower, eat? How does one manage living in a car?
Well, the humiliation, excuse me, like the embarrassment, humiliation, and fear that goes into using a restroom outside, like. When you know the police can drive by, cars are driving by,
like
and
some bush
you're either,
somewhere,
and you—that's your choice. That's your option. Like there is no choice. Actually, I'm sorry. It's you're either you got to go, and that wears on your mind, it wears on your soul. You know.
And then what about showers and brushing your teeth?
What we'd have to do. A lot of times, we'd have to get hotel rooms. Other times, before work, if I'd have like a 5 a.m. shift, it was baby wipes, and I'd just clean myself with baby wipes. School. Once we enrolled in school, we figured out and started going to school consistently. We figured out who to talk to. About situations where even down San Diego and then here at Butte College where we could use the shower with special permission at the gym and brush our teeth there. But it when you don't have that option and it's like a Chico summer that's like was hot as last summer and it's 80 degrees at midnight.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Like, it's still really, really tough to just keep that, you know, keep yourself clean and, you know, in good spirits. There's a lot of stigmas that go where people, like when Bob said, people look at the lady that said, people look at me like I'm a monster. Sometimes they look at you like that. Sometimes they don't look at you at all. They look through you like you're invisible. It's really strange and... it's unsettling, very unsettling. And sometimes you just, like, you know, you feel helpless. Fortunately, I was able to meet some good people through Butte College, and they introduced me to the folks at CHAT, and they were able to help us out. And
so you had like sleeping bags, and your brother would sleep in the front, and you would sleep in the back seat or something like that.
It was a smaller car, so it was just move the seats back as far as they could go.
Oh wow!
And push the stuff back as far as they could go. And I was usually on the driver's side, so try not to, you know, smash your knees against the against the steering wheel, and just hope you get some good sleep. A lot of times you get woken up by the police. A lot of times you get woken up by someone that's out there, and they might have mental illness. They might have a problem. They might just be desperate. They might be, and they're slamming on your window and screaming, and it's unsettling. You understand what they're going through, and you're just like, you know, maybe they just want in the car to sleep too, you know. But it definitely wasn't a situation that I think I would ever have imagined. And then to be on the other side of the fence, to see both sides of it, it's really hard to listen to when people are like, oh, that guy's just a bum, or that guy, he doesn't know what he's doing, or he must be on drugs. And you just hear all these like stereotypes of like, oh, you know, total. And you're like, that's not the case at all. Like, really? Like, I mean, it is in some situations it is, but it's because people are going through trauma. They're having problems. It's not, they're human beings, like, you know. And
then would you just do like fast food to eat?
A 99-cent menu fast food. Was fortunate to have the Cal Fresh for a while. Unfortunately, with the Cal Fresh, you can't buy hot food, so you don't have a place to cook food.
No,
so you can buy cold raw food,
like sandwiches and stuff.
You could buy the sandwiches, but like if you wanted to just like buy like a hot bowl of like soup or some sort of something just with some that you feel it has more nutrients in it, then like, you know, you can't. They put a restriction on the hot food. So it doesn't make sense to me, but.
So you could only buy groceries, I think, is what he's saying. But if you don't have a home, you have no place to cook it.
Hello.
It's right. Crazy.
You could always put it on the motor of the vehicle, but then you're using gas up. So, I mean, it's a lose-lose situation. But I do want to say something about both these guys, he and his brother. They have a 3.85 grade point average.
Yay.
And they work so hard at school. And to think of being homeless in a car, the fear, the loneliness, all of the things that are accompany that kind of lifestyle, and yet having the desire and the drive to get an education, right? And it's so beautiful to see that. They live in a house that we have, actually it's a CHAT house that we started when we heard about homelessness with students, where we have 6 students in that house, and we just had one graduate with a master's, one graduate with a bachelor's, and others going on to Chico State, one in Chico State, others going on to Chico State. So given that opportunity, and my point is not just these guys, but given that opportunity again, so many people living on the street need a second chance because something has happened in their life to take that first chance away. And so what we see the need for in this community is people to have that second and maybe even a third chance. Because we see the success of people once we get them in. We know also that it takes at least a year for most people, and we see it with these guys, the trauma, to change that brain back. When you've been on the street and you're living that life and the things that you accompany that kind of survival, it changes your brain, it changes your mind, and it takes at least a year. That somebody knows that the person there is not going to be going away. We're there to support them. And that's the beauty to me about CHAT is that we're there to support them. They know we're not going away. We give them a second chance. We know the trauma that they've gone through. We're not judging that. Our judgment, obviously, is, are you ready? You know, are you ready to step up? And sometimes it's a little baby step. You know, some of our people stepping up means that they're no longer in a hospital. They're no longer interacting with the police. They're no longer, going to jail, to the courts, to interaction with the fire department, because that's what they were doing on the streets because of whatever situation we're in, whether it's mental illness or whatever it happens to be. we see the drugs fall away, we see the alcohol fall away, and we see the brain change where they are now saying, I can, where there's hope. And some people, that hope is just being stable and having some income and paying for their room and paying for food and other things in our society, rather than having that cost to society to leave people on the street. And that's the thing that people don't understand. When they dehumanize and demean people on the street, they're keeping them there, rather than saying, what is the answer? And so for us, it's you know, we're looking for the opportunity to put those people in there. You know, so it makes, when you are an obstructionist, which I see so many people in this community are obstructing things changing, that really hurts, because they are actually making the situation worse. When you think of a woman on the street or a young man on the street, many of the women have someone in their life, some man, because it's better having been abused by one person than being on the street and being afraid for the other things that can happen to you.
The devil that's not.
Yes, exactly. And we see it all the time. So, you know, it's really hard for us to see that, because we see the success once we get people inside. And that makes a community safer. It also, as the chief of police has told me, Bob, when you bring people in, you get rid of predators. Because people prey on those vulnerable people, whether young women, young men, old men, any kind of a woman, any situation, someone's going to try and prey on them for their own livelihood. Mm. And we remove people, that removes those predators in our community.
My dentist told me that there's kind of an epidemic of kidnapping young women to go in the sex trade. Is that true in Chico?
That's obviously we haven't seen it, but that's what we hear. That there's people, what I was told by someone in his community, a police officer, that within, I think it was 17 minutes, a young woman arriving in his community without support, someone will be hitting on her. So it's very frightening. Very frightening what happens, because they're vulnerable. People see that vulnerability. They step in. A backpack, and they step in as if they're a savior. They're going to help them. In reality, they're there to, again, prey upon them.
That's,
if nothing else, we should have places where, you know, where women can go just to be safe. But then I think, well, there's women, but then there are, what about children, families with children? It's terrible when they're living in cars and they're, you know, are having to stay in a homeless shelter and, you know, get picked up by the school bus and, you know, at a shelter. Mm. That's not too great. And then you see disabled people, people with physical disabilities going down the road in a wheelchair or something.
Oh,
with
gosh.
It's horrible. So I don't know who's the most vulnerable, but what Chat's been doing is we just keep trying to expand and reach out. We did start the student house because we were contacted by Dawn Blackhorse at Butte College. She kind of got us started, and also Joe Picard and the Wildcat Food Pantry at Chico State. They both were letting us know, you know, we have students that need a place. So we said, well, we should open a student house. And then we're thinking about opening a house for people with physical disabilities.
We just purchased a piece of property for that is an ADA-compliant house. And we thought, well, you know, we might as well go in that direction as well, because it's not happening. We see people on the street, as Leslie was saying, in wheelchairs
or
on crutches. And it's like, maybe we can help in there as well.
Let me ask Dustin, do you feel like you have PTSD at this point?
I talk to someone twice a week.
Good.
About all the things that I've gone through. It's gotten a lot better when I realized that about what I was going through after I got into the house, that it hadn't.
It was trauma, and
the trauma hadn't left the body.
Yeah,
it definitely hadn't left the body, and I got in touch with some people, and they put me in contact with someone and I still speak with them most of the time, two times a week, unless I'm, like, right now, I'm about to go back to school, so once this week.
So what are the triggers at this point?
Just a lot of times, just an unsettling memory can just trigger it and just set something off, and you just, one thing that I've noticed about, just like my brother and I, is just when I would take, like, when I was working full time and going to school, we would go and we would go on like a Priceline type site, and we would like get a hotel room for a couple of days or whatever to to get clean,
take
a shower, and do it.
Sleep.
And what happens is, I think for both of us, is when we do get like a heavy anxiety about things, like it's a very strange thing, but our first, like, kind of both of us, our first thought is, let's get a room. Like, even though we have a house.
That's not strange. It totally makes sense. That was a safe place.
Yeah. And but we have a house to live in now, and we're settled in there. And it's good, but we still have this, like, it's this crazy, or let's get a room for a couple days.
Yeah, but it's not crazy. You know what I would do is, when you feel that anxiety, I'd imagine the most luxurious, wonderful hotel room and just imagine being in there. Because the unconscious doesn't know the difference between what you imagine and what's real. So I wouldn't say it's crazy. I'd say, oh, yeah, I'm going to go with this fantasy.
But I've seen how much more healthy they are. When they came, at the trauma, it was so sad, actually. And I understood the trauma. I mean,
how long have they been in the house?
Just over a year now.
A little over a year. Right.
I haven't seen you in a while, Dustin, and I really noticed... I notice a difference. And
what
just
do you
in
notice?
His demeanor, he just seems so
calmer.
Much more calm and clear and focused.
And engaging, which was really difficult because of, I'm sure, the trauma that he was going through.
And people rejecting you.
Rejecting,
you're not going to be
right,
Mr. Outgoing.
Right. So, and being able to handle more. Right.
I think you used to be more withdrawn, you know.
Right.
Now you're more expressive, and it's great. It's just great hearing you tell your whole, you know, your thoughts and views and story and everything.
Thank you. A lot of it too is kind of heartbreaking when it does happen. Of you lose a lot of friends really fast. You do. I don't know if they think it's contagious or whatnot, but it feels that way, and it's. That was kind of heartbreaking. Is then trust issues come into play too.
Oh yeah.
And then you don't know who to trust. Like, you know, I mean, Dawn was amazing and
at Butte.
Yeah, and just introduce my brother and I to Bob and Leslie and help us get in the program and everything like that. It was a miracle though. And
what's Dawn's title?
She's a. She works with the Student Services and Success. So I actually was in her office yesterday, kind of catching up for the summer, finding out how her summer was and letting her know how mine was. And
oh,
was
good.
And she's always just very encouraging, very helpful. Yeah.
So you're debating between majoring in history or media production and then going to grad school.
Yeah. So, it's...
And he's... you're also teaching, aren't you?
Oh, so now, yeah. I also just got a job with the school, helping tutor.
At Butte.
So they're tutoring statistics.
Oh, you're good in math, too.
Yes. Turns out. I didn't think so. But school is a... That's been a really, just going there, and when I'm not at the house resting, I'm usually at school. I find a lot of different support systems there and very comfortable at school. So I try to get involved as much as possible. So I was going to the tutoring center to hang out and meet and get help with my own studies, and you meet other people that are into school as much as you are, and then you're there like every day, and then all of a sudden someone's like, you want to work here? I mean, you show up every day and you know this stuff.
And you actually were helping your brother do a paper, right? Aren't you? Is that you ended up doing history? So now you have an interest in history because you actually were helping your brother with a paper he was researching, and you became the research assistant, kind of.
So he's working on a paper, and he's just like, I need more information about this, and because he's looking everywhere, and I'm running around the library and all over the internet. I'm like, I'm just sending him stuff. I'm like, I'm just going to send you everything, and you can pick and choose what you need out of that. And it helped them out a lot.
I'm assuming that smartphone enables all this kind of communication if one is living in a car.
Oh, yeah, you depend on that a lot. Like,
and then you charge it at work or something.
Yeah, it's always... always a... always on the search for a hidden place to charge your phone.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KZFR FM, and we serve the North Valley, Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And the views expressed on this program don't necessarily reflect those of the station or the supporters. And we want you to know that Ask Dr. Gale is on the second Thursday of every month. The next one, I'm going to need your help with women who are in non-traditional jobs serving as role models, especially looking for police officers and firefighters. No luck yet, and I've really been trying. And remember that the videos of the shows are on my YouTube channel. Just search Gail Kimball. Well, let's talk about chat, because we mentioned it about a million times. So how did it get started? And
one quick statement before. Dustin and Justin's situation is unique, but the situation is not unique. We find it everywhere. I mean, the situation that they find themselves in is so prevalent in this community, the pain, the fear, the things that are happening, and the PTSD, which is so real. It's just really interesting because it sounds like a unique story, but it, for them it is unique. But it's not a unique story in our community. And that goes back to what I see as a judgment of people who are unhoused, the people that are lost their homes, are facing the dehumanization. And it's so unfortunate, because if you talk to people on the street, if someone would just take the time to talk to someone in the street, it could change your whole life.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Grace.
Hi there. How are you?
There's a chair right here. So while Grace is getting settled, let's talk about chat. How did it start? Who started it? Chico Housing
Action Team. It started about 6 years ago, this late October. It was 6 years ago, and it was a group of people, Leslie, me, Sheldon Prazer, Dan Everhart, a group of people that started getting together and started talking about this is crazy. For me, the biggest thing, and I don't know about Leslie, but for me was going to a 10-year meeting about ending homelessness in the community, which was about 15 years down the line. And I just remember being so upset, because after the meeting of putting all these great ideas on the board, the person running the meeting took a picture and said, "This is great, let's meet again in 6 months."
Oh, gosh.
And I realized, for me, it was like, this is crazy. We know we can do something. So a group of people started meeting and talking about what we can do about homelessness. And there was a freeze coming. And a really cold spell in November of that year, 2013. And Dan Everhart said, "Well, maybe we should do something tonight." And so that night, we ended up having our first safe space at the Peace Center, and then at the Jesus Center, followed up the next week. So we just had our first safe space at that point.
How did you get the word out to homeless people?
It was not difficult at all. We had, in the Peace Center, we had, I think, 37 people, some people with dogs, some people with carts, literally laying together. But we filled the Peace Center up the very first night, and for the whole week.
You can probably just get the word out at the plaza.
It was real easy. That was not a problem at all. But we didn't have a lot of women, and that has changed to probably 60-40. At that point, it was mostly men. We had the first year, it was a man, I think, Hispanic man. It was 92, living on the streets.
Oh, my goodness.
Since passed away. Anyway, that started at that point. We always wanted to build houses, truly affordable houses. That was our goal, I think.
One thing I really liked, when we were trying to pick a name, you know, we struggled with that, and then one of the things we agreed on right away is we wanted action right in the middle of that name, because of just what Bob said. You know, we would go to meetings, and we really did reach out to learn as much as we could about what's already happening. We didn't want to be stupid and just,
reinvent,
you know,
the wheel.
Yeah, so we started going to meetings of the Greater Chico Homeless Task Force, Strategy to End Homelessness, and the Mayor's Council on Homelessness, and all these, every place we could, and talking to agency people and people that were already working in this area. But then we wanted to just go for it, and I think at first people, especially in the provider community, that we were really naive, which I guess we were in a way, but we were really, really determined to try to just do stuff and make something happen. And I hope that we're, as much as anything, we're an inspiration in the community, that you know, you don't have to wait for somebody else to do something. You can just figure something out and just start doing it. And sometimes we don't know if it'll work, and then, you know, it does. And
is Safe Space still going on, or is that a winter thing?
We believe it will go on this year. We spun it off. So this last year, that we actually weren't part of Safe Space, and another nonprofit took it over. But building on what Leslie said, we actually traveled. Leslie and I traveled and made a movie. We traveled to other states and filmed villages that were already up and going to find out each one worked. And then we were looking, okay, what would be the best practices for Chico out of all of these different communities
if
we're going?
If people want to see the video, is it on YouTube?
I don't even know.
There are a lot more videos now that are
We are making more videos through Respectful Revolution.
Yeah, that was specifically to visit tiny house villages in Oregon and Washington. Yeah, and now Respectful Revolution has gone and done much more professional videos and a lot of...
Gerard Ungerman.
Gerard Ungerman and Stacy. We just weren't professional, but we thought we wanted to learn, and we wanted to have it recorded so we could bring it back to our community, which is what we did.
I think it is on YouTube.
It is on YouTube.
It's called, what is it called? The Way Home.
The Way Home, right.
Yeah, we really like the idea of a tiny house village. That was partly from Dan Everhart, too.
Yes.
And, in fact, the house that we're buying right now was Dan's house.
Dan's house,
and
right.
It's,
it's not tiny, though.
It's not a tiny house. It's a house that will be for people with disabilities because he was wheelchair bound, and he had the bathroom, like a roll-in shower and stuff. And we've been talking to, again, we talked to these other agencies, and they all end up asking us, can you Disability Action Center, do you have any houses? We really have all these people. And some of the case managers, they say, we're so frustrated. We spend all our time working with them to help them get housing, and we go through lists, and we teach them to make phone calls and fill out applications, but they don't get anything. And
Or they get a voucher, a Section 8, and there's no housing.
5 out of 100. That's about the rule right now.
Five out of the people who have the vouchers.
Yeah. So there again... Debbie Villasenor, I think, first suggested, why don't you do master leases? And that turned out to be a good thing. And it's sometimes I think the simplest ideas are the best. You know, that's why, too, we came up with Simplicity Village for our tiny house village. And master leasing is simple, too. It's really following the kind of the student group model where you rent a big house and then sublet the bedrooms and everybody pays a share of the cost. And it works because Chico has way more large houses than we really need, and we're a great shortage of 1 and 2 bedroom and studios. So we're just having to adapt to that environment.
How does one handle the roommate situation? You're messy, I'm neat. You eat my food that's in the community refrigerator. You are noisy at night. You have a dog. I'm allergic to a dog.
It depends on the house. Many of our houses, we meet literally weekly. Sometimes as a whole group, sometimes we have someone assigned to an individual if that individual has trauma or some needs. And then we really work hard at trying to do two things. Find the right group of people for the house that would work together. And then we create community. We work really hard at making them feel like it's a family.
Mm. And it's honestly a great learning opportunity for people, too, because we're working with communication skills and learning that, you know, if something's bothering you, you don't have to either just keep it inside or just blow up. You can actually talk about it and tell people how you feel. And, I mean, it's there's no greater opportunity for developing those skills than having to live with other people.
Is there some kind of like a leadership hierarchy? Like I'm the treasurer and you're the secretary.
You mean as far as chat or in the house?
In the house.
Many times someone will emerge in the house. We have meetings, and many times someone will emerge as the individual who. People might be the go-to person too. They see this is a person, but many of the houses are just. Everyone's kind of equal. They eat their own food. They don't cook together. But we come in once in a while. We'll come in. We'll have a pizza party. We'll have, you know, at Thanksgiving, we bring all the people together for a big party from all the houses. Mm. So they get to know each other. So it depends on the house and the needs of the house. We have one house that is a duplex, 4-bedroom, 2-bath, 4-bedroom, 2-bath, and all the people there have severe mental illness. And we work with them, and it takes a lot of energy. We actually have somebody that is there quite a bit that is actually our first employee to make sure.
Our only paid staff
only
person.
Paid
the
staff
rest
person.
Of our case management is all volunteers. Wow. All
is that
volunteers.
A social worker there?
She's not a licensed social worker.
Not a licensed social worker, but somebody that's worked with veterans and has had a lot of experience like the rest of us because we've trained ourselves. I mean, we've gone to so many seminars and put on seminars and brought speakers into the community like Lloyd Pendleton and put on that whole seminar about homelessness and housing first. And that kind of was one of our things that occurred then was our Housing Now program, like I was saying earlier, that we have 36 houses and 119 people off the street. And there'll be more in the next few days. We'll have more people off the street. Okay. So, and we've learned a lot by that. We've learned an awful lot because we meet with people. We see our mistakes. We have to eat it and live our mistakes that we make. But overall, we have a real relationship where I know, like I did just before we came in here, I had 5 texts. Mm-hmm. Because if there's something going on in the house that people are concerned about or worried about one of the people, they let us know like this. They trust that it's not going to hurt them, it's not going to go anywhere, that we're there to make that better and not put blame on it. So we have just a tremendous relationship with almost all our houses. Are they all easy? They're not.
No. Let's introduce Grace. Grace, you wanted to kind of chime in here. You can put that on the table. You don't have to.
Yes, I did. Can you hear me okay if I do so? Bob and Leslie are an example of what I'm going to say. I think that their program and project is a project in excellence with not only great intention, but willingness, openness, and training. And they've evaluated what they lack knowledge in, and they went and got information about it. It's just that easy. And then they stay with it. They're committed.
Difficult.
They're dedicated. and they keep a close eye out and watch their baby grow in all 4 corners.
Duncan already told his story. Why don't you, if you would, tell yours about how
Dustin.
You, Dustin, sorry. Dustin. Thank you. How you came to be living with a bicycle.
Well, I came to California first to Fremont on an invitation, and I had a longer-term invitation here to Chico. My friend had been here 3 to 5 years and owned a trailer and was inviting me to rent it, share it, or buy it. And I had never experienced housing saturation before. Mm-hmm. So being hard-headed like I am, I did not believe. She didn't really warn me. And then when I got here, I didn't really believe it would be a problem. I just thought, hey, I'm 60, I'm sober, and I have a stable income, and people are going to be lined up to rent to me anything I want. I want a big, expensive place, I'll get it. I want a little dinky, cranky place, I'll get it. Not to be, and I was a misfit. I did not fit in. I found that any shelter I went to, I was looked upon with mistrust and suspicion.
Why? I mean, like you say, you're a white, sober woman.
Well, first of all, the homeless, the staff has a level of burnout in the Torres, let's say, and I really believe the other places to accept a project like Chet. I think that they have a level of burnout, not just from the volume and the issues of the mentally ill, but the political polarization here and the conflict that they go through and they nurse constantly. They mistrusted me because I comb my hair different, I look different. I'm a sugar addict. I'm not a meth addict. You know, and a friend of mine just recently told me, just last week, they look on you worse than the police if you're not doing the same drugs that they are.
And so, what drugs are they doing?
Crystal meth.
Oh, the homeless.
Yeah.
Oh, I get it.
So I came here from the Midwest. I left a really bad several situations there to make a new start here, to be a positive addition to the community here, get housing, kind of live low, lay low, and go to the yoga. I consider California the mothership of psychotherapy, and it is holistic healing and whatnot. And I am starting to make progress, but I had several hoops of ego to get over. So I tried about 20 living situations, and different landlords kind of fibbed to me. And then when I tried the shelters, the bedding didn't work. I have back problems, and I have this problem and that problem. So kind of word gets out that I'm a difficult personality. So Chat just recently passed me by, according to their best judgment, and they, you know, and I don't fault them for that. Now my new system is that I just applied for Section 8. I'm a priority because I'm homeless, disabled, and a senior. So I'm blitzkrieging the area with applications, both Section 8 and lower income. And then I'm going to, you know, possibly go to free school. You know, and the thing is that my friends that can help me, that want to help me, can't because their owners are so rigid and won't let them have like a 6 month or a temporary year long roommate. And I mean, I'm a team player, so it's really difficult.
So how long have you been without a home?
I've been lucky. I sofa surf. I go to websites and I sofa surf. But it's been a year and 8 months, a year and 10 months here. It's pretty hard. I mean, just now today I got overheated and this was a mild day.
So where do you sleep if there's not a sofa available?
Why do you ask?
Because I want people to understand what it's like to not have an address.
I sleep on the lounge chair next to a big swimming pool in a Vegas-like setting. No, it's an undisclosed area. It's an undisclosed area, and I have about 5 pads, and I still can't get comfortable. I raise 2 kids. My 2 kids are connected. They've gone to school. They're clean living. Have jobs, apartments, cars, friends, vacations, wardrobes. And then I come here, and it's been prove myself to each and every person over and over again. Which brings me to the Catholic worker system for shelters. The Catholic worker system in shelters would play well with everything else here.
What is that?
Chat plays well with everybody. It would be... not low barrier. People would be allowed to be drunk or stoned or drug addicted.
Or have pets or something.
They wouldn't be tested, breathalyzed. Well, yeah, here in California, the pets is a non-issue, okay? So, yeah, their pets could come in. They wouldn't be required to see a doctor, but they'd be offered these services. It would be a focus of services that would come with a ready-made set of rules that are user-friendly for everybody, that gives everyone their civil rights.
Well, wasn't that the low-barrier housing that was proposed for Orange Street near the university that got shut?
Yes, and it had every great idea except the safe space, board themselves, are hostile and offensive people who must vent. And they turn people off like that. They turned me off. And I'm a rule follower.
So Safe Space was connected with the Orange Street?
Yes, yeah, Safe Space board was going to open the Orange
Jesus
Street.
Center and Safe Space.
Bob, why don't you comment on it? What happened to the Orange Street space?
Well, we weren't part of that.
We know
that there was a tremendous amount of pushback, as you were suggesting. It's just a tremendous amount of pushback that there would be people there. The kids walking by would be in danger. There were
to laugh about that myself. So Gail Hutchison, the president of college, had a she publicly opposed it because it didn't seem like it would be good for students to have to walk by and see homeless people sitting on the street. But I just laughed to myself because we've tried to get houses in the student area before, and our homeless people have told us, I don't really want to live in the student neighborhood. They're so loud. They're so drunk. They party all night. Do I have to live there in that area? It was kind of funny because it's all about stereotypes and that kind of judgment.
And we also Bob. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
This is what the issue is: the middle class, the homeowners, and the business, because Safe Space wants to do too much, and they wind up enabling people to stay stagnant in their same spot. They had great ideas. They had in-house case management, health care, and all kinds of stuff. That's wonderful. But the accountability factor is why what Leslie and Bob are saying, that the college wouldn't go along with, and Jesus Center wouldn't go along with, because the rules would be a safety net from the Catholic worker system, which are non-religious, to be in everyone's best interest and provide accountability. People could go there drunk and stoned, like Safe Space Board wants them to. They can be mentally ill. They can get their services. But they would be responsible on an individual type basis to follow rules, and rules would be enforced.
So what are you finding in terms of availability with your Section 8 voucher?
I'm going to have to go. If I get something in Butte County or Chico especially, it'll be a miracle. My Section 8 won't come through for about a year or two probably at this point. So I would like to enjoy the next year or two in a lowish, affordable room, and enjoy college and energy healing and
yoga.
Where
do you get energy healing?
Well, at the Shalom Clinic on Wednesday nights by a fabulous lady named Gail Kimball, does chakra balancing. And
we have Joe Ray and sometimes Reiki. It's every Wednesday, drop-in free from 5 to 7 p.m. at 1010 Mangrove, part of Shalom.
Right, but the Catholic worker system is also kind of in place at the Iverson, I believe. So I'm
What's
getting
Iverson?
The Iverson Center is a walk-in clinic with fabulous facilitator workshops, of which I think Safe Space should take these workshops, each person on the board.
We are, as chat, we have taken some, actually, and it's actually, the Iverson Center is part of Behavioral Health. They have they're tied to them, but it's an amazing place. It's so well run and caring and loving, and they do a great job.
People
and what we've
feel
kind of
valued yeah. there. They feel valued. One young
Respected.
Man I met, He has published comic books ongoing. Another young lady makes jewelry, does makeup, hair. The groups that we had to come up with, like our sample groups at the end of the course, were cutting edge. I mean, I'm an old bat, and I say that they were cutting edge.
You're not that old. Could you say a word about if people who are listening want to donate to chat, how could they donate?
Oh, well, they can certainly send a check. That's the good old-fashioned, tried-and-true way. That's one way. Chat, P.O. Box 4868, Chico, California, 95927. We recently did a GoFundMe campaign. You might have seen that. And we raised a lot. We raised
$158,000.
Wow.
And
yeah.
then we had someone who shall not be named because they asked not to, actually asked to have a meeting with Leslie and myself, and they handed us a check for $50,000.
Right. But
so,
unfortunately, really the project that we're trying to raise money for primarily right now is the Tiny House Village. And
the Simplicity Village.
It's so expensive because, land in Chico, it's the biggest problem.
But you
land
have 2.5
is
so, acres.
We have 2.6 acres. But to put in the infrastructure is tremendously expensive. We have to bring a sewer,
water,
550 feet. We have to bring water. We have to bring electricity. We have to so all of these things. We have to grade the area. We have to deal with now there's rain and there's buildings. So now you have to deal with where does that water that was normally going to the ground? How do you deal with that? You have to. So it's incredibly expensive. So we have all of the expenses to do that. Then we have to have two community centers, and we have to have a building, which is really neat because we're going to be working right there with Behavioral Health. So we have to have a building for meetings, for other organizations, community organizations that could be a part of it to help us make sure that all services are available for the people. So all of that becomes very expensive. We're looking at maybe $1 million, but you're looking at 33 homes, as many as 50 people. That's not a lot of money,
right.
But it is for us because we're volunteers. We
right.
have one just recently paid position. So we've been unbelievably fortunate in this community that the outpouring has been amazing. The amount of money that's been donated is amazing. However, is we need a lot more
right.
to do what we do because we are volunteers. We spend it out of our pocket. We
right.
don't, you know. You can go to chicohousingteam.net. You can look on the internet at some of our videos, Respectful Revolution. You can become a sustaining member where it helps us tremendously. We know somebody's sending us a check every month for $10, $20, whatever you can afford. That helps us tremendously because when we budget, we need to know what's out there for us. Because
right.
we have three programs. We have the Housing Now program. We have a hush program where we're taking families in crisis and bringing them inside and helping them with everything, every social service, helping them how to set up a bank account, how to work with your children, what is good practices. We're surrounding them with services that they need. And then we're looking at Simplicity Village. So, and we're talking about other programs as well. We just Leslie just brought one up at the last meeting. Why don't we start doing this?
So I just wrote a grant today. Right. That's for the one I was telling you about before we got started for co-signing for people. Because, you know, we're always puzzling over what are the ways that we can leverage, you know, a certain amount of money to help the most people. And
a lot of landlords won't rent without
Three times. So if you have a job where you have a 900, go ahead, I'd let you finish.
Well, yeah, so Bob's talking about there are a lot of arbitrary restrictions that the landlords and the property management companies have on who they'll rent to.
Sure.
And they have their property owners association that, and it's created a lot of uniformity, which can be good, but also in a way bad because of the rigidness of some of their standards. So they want to look at people's salary, and if the rent's $1,000, they want to see that people make three times that amount, and that's just standard. And they also want to see they haven't had an eviction in 5 years, or they haven't they have a certain credit rating, and you know that cuts out a ton of people.
Right.
So I'm trying to get us going with a co-signing project, a way that we can co-sign for people, because
like an insurance policy for
exactly.
The landlord.
We insure.
It's a commitment.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Dustin, let's go back to you. And I'm curious what you find living with a group. What are the dynamics? Because it's unusual to have a group of people living together where there aren't conflicts and irritations.
The group meetings are great.
Wait, how many people live in your house?
We have six.
And do you each have your own room?
My brother and I share a room. And then everyone else has their own room. We kind of, my brother and I prefer it that way, so it was,
And what are the issues that come up, and how do you deal with them?
Most of the time, I think everyone gets along, just like anything else in life. I think that sometimes it's just, sometimes people get on each other's nerves in the house, or they're not used to just the communal living and just re-getting used to it after a traumatic situation. And certain people are particular about certain things, other people aren't so particular. So it's, it hasn't really got too bad, but it only gets bad when there's a lack of communication, mm-hmm. when people are holding back,
mm-hmm.
and then that volcano erupts.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, At our house, we go every other week, and we'll have a group meeting, and people can express their concerns and different situations that are happening in the house, and we can talk about it with people, we can talk about it with each other, and it gets resolved.
We have group hugs afterwards sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, so it's you know, I really enjoy going there and talking to people, and because you know some of us had trauma in our life before we started doing this. And everyone in that house has had major trauma before they came there. And so that certainly plays a role in it, because everybody has different triggers. And so we have to work with that. What triggers you does not maybe trigger Dustin,
right.
and vice versa. So it is not always easy. And so we have to work with that, understanding that sometimes some person actually may require more attention because of the triggers and trauma in their life. And so we work with that, and I really enjoy the meetings that we go to. I mean,
we have left. Grace, you had a kind of program in mind that you knew about in St. Louis that you thought would be a model. What was that program?
Yes, in addition to the Catholic Worker model, for shelters where people could go and to rely upon the stability of these universal, balanced, equality-type rules, you know, very few, not many. I had a stipend program in mind with discussion groups on health, hygiene, and fitness, alliances, not addiction, you know, stuff like that. The stipend program itself would be 6 hours a week of therapeutic activities for them,
like gardening,
AOD, 12-step meetings, yoga, acupuncture, psychotherapy.
So the people without a home would get paid a small fund to do something.
Right. It would be a progressive kitty from $25 up to $150 in a 6-month period.
And how was the program that you knew of in St. Louis funded?
Well, I don't know. So I'm not as experienced as Bob and Leslie are, so I was going to have a quarter brigade.
What's that?
People who give, already give to panhandlers, and people who are inclined to give. And I would help to, my intention is to help depolarize the town. And then have all the above have mandates and requirements that you have to have like a 90-day residence before you can get help to kind